Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast. In this episode, Brian Strauss joins me to talk about his interviews with Wayne Rooney and FIFA President Gianni Infantino. Plus, we give our thoughts on the still-ongoing U.S. men's coaching search and the career of Clint Dempsey. A quick reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. It helps people find us. Onward! Let's bring in Brian Strauss from Washington, D.C. Brian, we haven't done this in 3 weeks.
I know. I don't feel bad about that. I mean, I miss you. I miss you personally, but I don't miss this so much.
I think listeners miss the podcast. I hope they do. I enjoyed doing this with you. It's good to get back on the horse here. I feel like, in a way, this is the start of a new four-year cycle, at least for me professionally. I always feel this way after the vacation that takes place after a men's World Cup. So I went to India for a couple of weeks with my wife, got completely away from the soccer world, totally disconnected, no Twitter on my phone, did a lot of reading. Whole thing was really quite enjoyable. And India is not really a soccer place.
I was going to say that that's one place you can go to literally get away from the soccer world, right? Is going to a country where the sport is what you tell me. It's not non-existent. That would be that may be overstating it, but it's hardly a country that revolves around the game.
Well, there's always Sporting Kansas City legend Sunil Chhetri.
Legend.
But aside from that, it was interesting.
Isn't he the captain of their national team?
I think so.
Like, the guy couldn't get a run in MLS and he's the captain of their national team. That's awesome.
But it was amazing just how little it is a part of the culture there. Like, you know, just driving around towns in India, I saw one haircut salon that had a picture of Neymar on the sign with like a Neymar cut. Not sure how many Indians asked for that cut. But
yeah, that's like a threat, you know.
But literally, that was it. It was just, if there was any sports stuff publicly, it was all cricket, basically.
So where did you go? What were the highlights of the trip?
So my wife's half Indian. Her dad's from the southern part of India. So we visited family there for about 5 days in Tamil Nadu. Flew into Coimbatore, went to this tiny farming village where he's from. It's pretty cool going halfway across the world and having relatives welcome you.
That's amazing.
You know, we're talking pretty remote India here where, like, you know, there was like a bucket for a shower, you know, but,
did you shower in that bucket?
Well, I didn't shower in the bucket. I used the bucket for the shower. Like
you filled it, a really large bucket. I'm just kidding.
You fill the bucket with
climbing in the bucket. I got you.
You fill the bucket with water. You lather up. You have a kind of ladle thing that you put in the water and you soap up and then you pour it over your head and your body and you're done. But really beautiful parts of India as well, too. We went to Rajasthan in the northwestern part of India and went to a few different cities there, like Jaipur and Jaisalmer and Jodhpur.
Did you have to fly or did you take one of those crazy trains?
No trains. Okay. We flew kind of the Indian version of Spirit Airways in Rajasthan.
Gotcha.
Ate well, ate a lot. I've been back in the gym quite a bit since then, but you know, I did keep one eye open to the soccer world, and obviously things have been happening. We got stories I want to talk about with you that you've been working on over the last couple of weeks on Wayne Rooney, Gianni Infantino. I want to talk to you about Clint Dempsey and his retirement and the U.S. coaching situation, which is still vacant. You talked to Dave Sarek and the caretaker. So it's not totally vacant, I guess. He's the caretaker, though.
It's crazy. It's crazy that, like, so I didn't really take a vacation after the World Cup. I just kind of slept and avoided working. I guess that's kind of a vacation, but I didn't go anywhere because I have nowhere to go and no one to go with. But like you said, this is the start of a new cycle. Sort of the sport revolves around these kind of four-year slices. And there really isn't any time. Nobody actually inhales and takes a deep breath and pauses. Like, the amount of stuff that's happened while you were away is insane. And it just kind of shows you that there's really no good time to sort of step away. So it's been busy.
Well, let's talk Wayne Rooney. You wrote a really good piece on him for SI.com, had a lengthy interview with Wayne Rooney, and he's been pretty fantastic, hasn't he?
Yeah, you don't even need to qualify it with pretty. He's been fantastic, and he has, and there have been, and what's neat is that in a culture where people are so unwilling to accept nuance or fault, or that maybe they should have looked at things in a different perspective. We puff our chests out and insist we're right over and over. I've seen so many people, and I was uncertain, and I was perhaps a little disappointed with my uncertainty. People would say, well, how do you feel about Wayne Rooney coming? And I just, like, I don't know if this is a good thing or not. But a lot of people thought it was a really bad idea. A lot of people thought that he was the wrong fit. He was too old, too much mileage, wouldn't care, was pandering on the part of the club. There was a lot of negativity and a lot of skepticism about his arrival. And I've seen so many people on social media. I've heard people say it in person, say, wow, I was wrong. And that's really, really refreshing to hear people say, you know what, I jumped to a conclusion here, and this is something that's really worked out a lot better than I imagined. And I didn't say any of that well, but it's a dynamic that I see existing, and give credit to the club, to Jason Levien, to Ben Olsen, to Wayne, of course, and the players around him for making this work. He's been a model DP. He's elevated the players around him. He's made them better. He's turned Lucho Acosta into an all-star level player. The relationship they've got on and off the field is really something to behold. And for this club that was really kind of sinking, for them to enter this new stadium, for them to bring in this player, and for them to go on the run that they've gone on, is one of the best stories in MLS right now. And they're a danger. I mean, they're a danger at this rate, accumulating points at this rate. With the games they have in hand, they have a really decent shot to make the playoffs, and that's quite remarkable.
I like how Acosta calls Rooney Senor Wayne.
Yes, it's very good. It is like Inspector Pavard. They it's like they've been playing together for a decade, man. I mean, Rooney sent Acosta through with a touch the other night against Atlanta for the third goal. That was the sort of stuff you work on for years, to get that timing down right, to recognize that run and the timing of it, and the anticipation required to have a sense of you know, the angle of that run and where it's coming from, and for, of course, Acosta to see the play unfolding and make the run. I mean, it was just it's just been, again, I'm sure people hate my Washington-centric view sometimes, but you know, I do live here. This is my town. This is soccer in my city, and it's been struggling to see this work out as it has. And I'll say this caveat, though, Wayne may get bored. I don't know if in a year or a year and a half he's still going to be, his application and commitment is going to be the same as it is now. He's getting a lot of home games. You know, he hasn't had to do the trips to Vancouver and Colorado. He hasn't had to go through the grind of the, you know, May, June, July in an MLS season. So who knows? The jury's out long term. He told us during the interview, you know, that he'd love to have his photo up someday in the stadium, and people can say, you know, Wayne Rooney came here and helped our team win. I mean, he really wants that kind of respect to sort of be to surround his time here. And obviously the jury is still very, very much out on that. But for a lot of people who thought that either A, he was here for the paycheck, that he wasn't going to work, that he wasn't going to do the little things, or that B, this was a move by DC United as they entered their new stadium to sort of pander to a fan base that's ignored them. Those people who believe that, and I get why they believe that, but those people who believe that, a lot of them have stepped up and said, you know, that this is more than I thought it would be. He meets with academy kids. He does all the media stuff they ask him to do. He's just been first class, like top to bottom. So it's been cool to see.
Well, I'd say a couple of things here. One, I'll raise my hand and say I was one of the people who said, not that this was a bad signing. I just wondered if it was, from an opportunity cost perspective, what else could DC United have done with that money?
Was it the right signing?
Right. Yeah. And yet, this has been great so far, obviously. The other thing I would say is I've never interviewed in a sit-down setting Wayne Rooney, ever. What was it like?
Well, I was a tandem interview. It was me and Stephen Goff from the Washington Post. So we got about, I don't know, 20 to 30 minutes with him. He's, for a guy who has spent so much of his life in the spotlight, he is still not, to say comfortable would be somewhat pejorative, because he's not uncomfortable. He's easygoing, but he, you can tell that this is not where he feels, his most, you know, capable and potent. You know, he knows that he is not, the most charismatic, you know, articulate, guy. You know, he's kind of really appealingly straightforward. I don't think he is devious or enough or to be inauthentic. You know, he's not a schemer. You know, he's pretty straightforward. He's got a sense of humor. We joked with him about running for Congress and why you know, because these guys never want to come here. You know, even though that's weird. It's like we're a big city. But we're never on anyone's list of places to be. You know, they want to go to New York, they want to go to LA. We are part of flyover country as well. So there was some interest in why he wanted to come to Washington. Obviously the money is nice. But he felt like this is also a city where, you know, he can get about the business of playing. He's not interested in being in movies, you know, that sort of thing. You know, he's going to build his brand a bit. I mean, he signed with Octagon, and they're going to do some work together, I suppose. But he could have done that anywhere. So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we met his wife and one of his kids and you know, just some cool things, you know, able to joke about the fact that, I mean, he never answers a question like I do with like a paragraph. It's always, you know, it's always brief and to the point. But he never had a roommate in his career. That's remarkable. You know, and when they said, hey, you know, we know you've never had a roommate before. Maybe you do horrible antisocial things in a hotel room and you just want to, like, stay with that. He's like, no, man, I'll have a roommate. So his roommate was David Osted, the goalie, who's now actually injured. You know, they offered him business class and flights. He turned it down. You know, we were told a story where he was literally sitting next to a member of the public who it was your worst nightmare, who was starting talking about Wayne Rooney, and he's sitting there on the plane, you know, and it was apparently one of these like business, it was one of these, you know, regional jets, right? So it's not a, you know, it's a 70 seat airplane, and Rooney's sitting there in coach getting jabbered at by someone, and he stuck it out, you know, he gutted it out and was happy to do it. So there's just these little things like that that indicate that he's a nicely simple, authentic guy. And yes, he's had some run-ins with the press. And yes, there have been, you know, tabloidy stuff about his marriage and his personal life. But, you know, he's not going to face that here. And he seems to be here for the right reasons, or at least here to do good work. And Atlanta is a buzzsaw. I mean, Atlanta can do some things on the field that we haven't seen often in MLS, and to see it done to them by Rooney and Acosta the other night was pretty interesting.
So you also had another pretty high profile interview while I was gone. Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, was in DC to see.
These are all people, right? These are all people you would have talked to instead of me if you've been here.
They did happen to be in Washington, D.C., so
that
I don't know
true.
If I agree with that.
Fair enough.
But Infantino was in town to see President Trump and his people. U.S. soccer people were there as well. A lot of talk about World Cup 26. What was your take on the whole thing?
It's cringy for me. Like, seeing the sort of the ham-fisted, awkward photo op nonsense in the Oval Office, the ring kissing and that kind of stuff. I have trouble even watching that. It's not like I watch it and get outraged and have an opinion. Like, I don't even want to see it. So to be quite honest, when I found out he was coming and we found out we'd get some time with him, I sort of focused on the journalism and the questions I wanted to ask and that sort of thing. And sort of, I just didn't want to, it's like staring at the sun, that stuff. Like, giving the red card to the press in the Oval Office and, giving the jerseys out. I just can't deal.
Let me just say that. The whole, that was bad. I mean, and U.S. soccer, in my opinion, doesn't need to be that friendly to Donald Trump.
The reason for the visit, I mean, Stephen Goff joined at the hip. Stephen Goff and I were the ones who were invited to speak to Infantino, and Carlos Cordero was there, and Dan Flynn was there, and Jay Berhalter was there. I mean, this is the U.S. soccer, power structure. And they explained why these relationships are necessary and convincingly. I mean, the amount of logistical work and political work that goes into hosting an event that's going to be this large, not only in terms of the number of teams and all the logistics and facilities required for 48 teams, but the fact that even that you've got border crossings not only from their countries to ours, but then between the three co-hosts, which has never been done before. So in terms of, different kinds of taxes, different kinds of licensing, different kinds of facility stuff and logistics and transport and charters and security. I mean, I guess there's a lot to do. And Infantino himself was like, look, we can't 2 years beforehand start sort of like hammering this stuff out. Like, we understand that as much as he'd like to be president in 2026, he may not be. And Trump made a joke about that, of course. This stuff has to start now. We have to start laying the basic groundwork for that now. We have to start letting the government know, whoever the government is, what's going to be, what we're going to need from them. And one of the things Infantino said was, look, the U.S. government has so many agencies and departments and different entities operating. It's like, we need a point person. We need essentially almost like a secretary of the World Cup. Those are my words, not his. But, someone we can reach out to and we have direct contact to, who can then be a point person to the different agencies we might need to deal with. So there was a legitimate reason for their visit here. Although, obviously, some of the optics, at least for me, were extremely cringeworthy.
Yeah, I just want to be clear. I think there's the stuff that needs to be there in terms of relationships to get the World Cup done. It's the same way I felt about the way Infantino acted with Putin at the World Cup. He didn't need to be his best friend, didn't need to say, our opinion of you and your country has changed as a result of this World Cup. The opinion of nobody's opinion of Putin changed from that World Cup, as far as I'm concerned.
They're all these guys, they're professional glad handers, right? I mean, that's what they do. I start to think about, is this, what's the World Cup worth? Yeah, I mean, you can lapse into sort of existential crisis about any of this, but at the same time, I'm in existential crisis all the time anyway. So, So I don't know, like you get an hour with Infantino, what are you going to do with it?
Let's talk about that. Yeah. So
I try to narrow it down and think, okay, you know, and it felt like being at the World Cup. I mean, it felt like, you know, we went to the hotel's a couple miles away from where I live, in Georgetown. And you get ready and you prepare and you quote and you ask and then you've got to turn it around. I wrote two stories of probably totaling close to 3,000 words all in that one day. And I was there till like 10 o'clock, you know, and it just had that same kind of feel of being at the World Cup and sort of cranking through something. But he's I get it. He's charismatic. He's easygoing. He's fluent in, you know, he's like C-3PO, you know, Cordero was there. Infantino is definitely more comfortable sort of in that kind of setting. Cordero's still getting there. He's a bit defensive and sort of would jump in, you know, here and there, sort of feeling, what's the word, under siege a little bit, even when he wasn't. We talked about why he was here. We talked a bit about the World Cup, the format, the logistics. You know, we talked about the future of sort of the global competition structure. You know, one of the things I was really curious about was, you know, when the World Cup was awarded to us in 1988, obviously the 94 World Cup, FIFA's mandate to U.S. soccer in 1988 was that you have to have a Division I professional league, you know, up and running for the World Cup. Now, obviously, it was a little bit delayed by a year and a half, but that was what FIFA wanted to see from the U.S. In exchange for essentially hosting the World Cup. And so I asked Infantino, you know, what would you like? Essentially the same question. What would you like? There are really weird things. Not weird is the wrong word. Really idiosyncratic things about the sports structure here in the U.S. A lot of them. And so whether it's, you know, pro rel, whether it's college soccer, whether it's training compensation, whether it's the disparate youth organizations that are all sort of competing for turf and players, you know, there's a lot of different things, obviously, that make us unique. So I asked Infantino, you know, what would you like to see, if any of that change? You know, is there something you want to see from U.S. soccer between now and 2026? And you'll have to read the story. I mean, he said, you know, he's European. He's used to things. He's very diplomatic. He's used to the way things are done there. That's the way he prefers it. But at the same time, he made it clear that he's not here to bully U.S. soccer or tell them how to run things. So
what did he say in specific about pro rel, promotion and relegation?
Essentially that. Essentially, you know, I love the excitement of pro rel. You know, that's also where I come from. And you know, Cordero, of course, makes the point then that, you know, the NFL and the NBA are really successful without having pro rel. Point being that there are different ways you can structure a league. And you know, as we've both said on this podcast before, there are hockey leagues and basketball leagues throughout the world that have pro rel and hockey leagues and basketball leagues throughout the world that don't. And the same with soccer. And obviously a lot more with pro rel than without, but the sport, the structure of a league doesn't define the game itself, doesn't define the sport as it's played on the field that day, on the court, on the ice that day. And so Infantino, as a lot of us feel, you know, I think pro rel would be great. I think it'd be more exciting, but it's not necessary to conduct a soccer league. And he's not going to, he didn't say that he was going to try to, you know, he said, I can be persuasive. You know, I can be annoying. I can have conversations. So maybe he's an advocate. Maybe he is in U.S. soccer's ear, trying to get them, you know, to think about things a different way. But it doesn't sound like there's going to be leverage used. It doesn't sound like there's going to be the bully part of the bully pulpit is going to be used that much. So
that's interesting to me. I mean, like,
this was also like a week and a half ago, and maybe I'm not remembering it right. So yeah, so read the story, clickbait.
I mean, a couple of things I would say here. One is that, you know, I do wonder if there might come a point when Infantino or FIFA might put pressure somehow on U.S. soccer on something like promotion and relegation for the leagues in America. I also remember from a context and history perspective, the week in 2010 before the vote for the 22 World Cup.
Oh, the calendar thing?
Where MLS has this press conference at the MLS Cup final
in Toronto,
and announces that, oh, we're going to reconsider the calendar and going to a fall to spring schedule like the rest of the world. And it was so obvious that they were doing it just for FIFA and the World Cup bid, which when it lost, nobody ever spoke about it again.
You know, I mean, I think, as I've said, my feeling on Prorel has always been that I don't want to see it forced. I want there to be a business case for it. I want the interest in the sport to be able to support teams that are relegated. I want the interest in the sport to be able to make the risk assumed by MLS owners worthwhile. You know, there's a lot of these stadiums and financial commitments that are getting made now probably may not happen if there's relegation. And so we need to figure out a way collectively, maybe the TV networks need to figure out a way to make the appeal of ProRel such that those risks are still worthwhile on the part of MLS owners. So I want there to be a business case for it. In other words, I want them to want ProRel. That's what I would ultimately like to see.
I am,
to force it on them.
I am with you on this.
When they entered into agreements that didn't have it, I don't think is right. And I think my sense is Infantino maybe felt the same way. He's not going to use the World Cup as leverage to get what he wants. But it sounded like from what he said, he would like to see it here eventually. And maybe the growth that Cordero talks about over the next 8 years in sponsorship and interest and participation and revenue, maybe somehow that feeds into a virtuous cycle where it happens. I don't know. It's like I said, man, I just needed to transcribe that and get out of there before midnight.
I do think you and I are on the same page on this. And it's part of it's because it's gotten such a toxic, you know, vibe around it on Twitter with promotion relegation in U.S. soccer, that the actual facts of what it would mean, you know, I don't have any issue with that, you know, but yeah, I don't want to see it forced on owners. I'd like to see there be a business case with incentives and have people want to do it. And I'd be excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah. If that were to happen, I'd be thrilled. But you know, I've tweeted about this before. I think Michael Lewis has written about it. I mean, the original plan in the late 80s, I even have a U.S. soccer program from like 1990 or 91, when there was a game here in Washington, where it talks about, you know, at that point, the World Cup had been awarded. We were still several years away. And it even talked about, you know, the future of professional soccer in the United States and the structure. And there would be three divisions with promotion relegation. I mean, this is a U.S. Soccer Federation document. And no one invested. You know, no, they couldn't get it off the ground because no one was willing to put up the money if they were afraid of getting relegated. And so they kind of had to shift to the structure we all know and love now in order to get the thing off the ground in the first place. So that's history. That's what happened. And so you now have to try to reverse engineer that in a way that's not going to be punitive to the people who took the initial risk and put up the initial money. They're the reasons we have the league in the first place. So I would like that balance to be found eventually. And I'd like to think it will be. And I'm not one. I'm not a child who has to have it now. You know, I just you see the trajectory of the sport in this country. It's unrecognizable from where it was when I went to whatever game that was in 1990. Unrecognizable. And it'll continue to evolve.
So let's hit on a couple other things real quick here before we wrap up. USA Brazil this Friday, friendly here in the New York area. Followed up by USA Mexico next Tuesday in Nashville. These are friendlies. The U.S. still doesn't have a coach, or at least they do. I keep saying that as if Dave Sarakin doesn't exist.
Yeah,
I like Dave.
I've stopped using the word interim in my stories. I mean, Avi will throw it in a headline or a cut line or something, but he's the coach. He's the coach until he's not. You know, and maybe that not will happen next month. But he's been the coach for 10 months. I mean, he's the coach.
The U.S. does not have a non-caretaker coach. Is that better?
I guess. I'm not using that word either. I mean, he's the coach.
Anyway, I'm still stunned. I would not have predicted sitting in that stadium in Trinidad last October, I would not have predicted that 11 months later, the U.S. would not have a non-caretaker coach.
Yeah.
But here we are. And now we see this week, Juan Carlos Osorio, who I think would have made a pretty good U.S. coach, has taken the Paraguay job. All signs seem to be pointing toward Greg Berhalter, if I'm being honest, from everything I'm hearing. What's your sense of all this? Like, I would have thought that it would have been better, and I've said this, that for these six friendlies, that's like 30 days that a full head coach could have had with the U.S. players. I think that would have been very useful.
Probably, although I think they also think Sarakin's doing a good job. And so I think if he... I know results in these games don't matter, but the fact is he's given debuts, I think, to 18 players. He's brought in, he's deployed two or three of the youngest lineups in the history of the program. And they've gotten out and they've been in games. And whether you win a friendly 1-0 or tie it 1-1 or lose it 2-1, that's irrelevant. What you want to see is these guys competing. You want to see them in games. You want to see them solving problems in games, being resilient when things don't go their way. And they've done that. And meanwhile, let's put it bluntly, he's a much nicer guy than either Jurgen or Bruce, right? He's just a much nicer man.
He's a nice
man. I'm sure he's just a much more of a pleasure to deal with. And if he's a much more of a pleasure to deal with for us, then he's probably even more so of a pleasure to deal with on the inside. And so, Tim Weah came out and said he'd love to see him get the job, right? And I know Tim Weah is not like the oracle of the U.S. national team, but obviously there's something clicking there that is giving U.S. soccer the sense that, it's better to wait and get the right guy than to just rush something in. And maybe I'm drawing a conclusion, but I'm not unhappy with what Sarakin's done so far. And for the people, again, on Twitter who are mewling and crying about the fact that we don't have a national team coach, what, should Sunil have hired the coach after Trinidad? Is that what you would have wanted? In December they made the decision to hire a GM. Would you have wanted to name the coach before they even hired the GM? Would you have wanted the accountant, Carlos Cordero, to appoint the head coach? Is he qualified? Okay, so then they went through the process of hiring the GM. That led to Ernie Stewart. Ernie Stewart started in August. So between August 1st and now, should Ernie Stewart have hired a head coach? Had he, everyone would have accused him of rushing, right? So it's like, yes, on one point, it's frustrating when you say it the way you did, that sitting in Cuba, you couldn't have imagined all these months later not having a coach. I get that. But in between, there was Sunil's decision not to run again. There was an election. There was the GM search. There was the GM's, what's the word, sort of getting him from Philly to Chicago and in place. I would have thought that Ernie, I would hope that Ernie had a list of people that should have been part of his interview, right? A big part. Who would you like to see as coach? What sort of things are you looking for? And the fact that there isn't one in place now, the fact that he didn't call Juan Carlos Osorio on day one and say, come interview for this job, leads me to believe that the guy or guys he's after aren't available yet. And so that points to MLS coaches, probably Berhalter, or maybe Peter Vermes, Greg Vanney. That maybe points to guys.
Why wouldn't they be available?
I mean, they are. I mean, I've had that conversation with somebody, actually. Like if Greg Vanney or Greg Berhalter needed to quit tomorrow to become the national team coach, I don't know. I mean, they are available, but they're not available. They're under contract. Maybe U.S. Soccer doesn't want to rock the boat. Maybe U.S. Soccer feels that Dave's doing a good enough job where they can wait till these guys are truly available. Maybe they're waiting for Jose Mourinho to get fired. Maybe Guillermo Scalotto. I meant Tata Martino, another example. I don't know, but my hunch is that the guy or guys are looking for, they're not in a rush. If they were in a rush to get Osorio, they would have gotten Osorio, but they weren't. So they've decided to take their time on this. A lot of people have theories about why. but I'd rather see this, and I'd rather see them get it right than have had a lame duck Sunil Gulati, appoint a coach in January. That would have been wrong.
Well, I'll try and make this as concise as I can about what I would have preferred to see happen. I would have preferred to see a new CEO to replace Dan Flynn, who everyone knows is a lame duck and is going to leave the job in a year or less anyway. And that new CEO earlier in the year, or right after the election in February, could have hired the GM. I think it would have been better for the GM to be hired by the new CEO than by Dan Flynn, who's a lame duck, because now you're going to have a new CEO come in anyway, and that GM, Ernie Stewart, will not have been hired by that CEO, or by that CEO. So that's a problem. So I would have wanted a new CEO in February or March. I would have wanted a much quicker hire on the GM, who could have taken the job earlier. That's the way the chain of command ideally should work. And then a coach could have been hired after the World Cup, right after the World Cup, I think. And
yeah, a huge problem is Stewart starting in August. And the reason he started in August was for all the things I laid out. Obviously, none of what I laid out was a new CEO, because that didn't happen. But yes, if Cord, I mean, I don't know, I guess it's the board, right? I guess the board, the board in December, when they decided to approve the GM job, again, I cover soccer, man, I don't know governance, but like, could they have ousted Flynn and said part of this purge is going to be new president, new CEO, new everything, and then a new CEO takes over in January, and then, or February or whatever, yeah, and then we have time to get a GM in place well before the World Cup, which means right after the World Cup, when there's some movement, maybe that's the time they grab the head coach they want. Unless the head coach they wanted is, like we said, is one of those guys who's going to finish out his MLS season and then move over to U.S. soccer.
Yeah, I still think it's going to be Greg Berhalter. In terms of Clint Dempsey, let's finish the podcast with Clint. Clint retired from soccer unexpectedly, a little interesting on the timing, but it also gave us the chance to look back at a truly incredible career from a guy who was from East Texas, from Nacogdoches, who was not part of the sort of elite youth development movement in the U.S., a guy who really worked, spent tons of hours on the road driving 3 hours each way with his parents to play club soccer in Dallas, who went to Furman for a couple years, and really had to make up for lost time because of that in a way, and then scratched and clawed his way to becoming one of the best U.S. men's players of all time.
It's a great story. I had to write a sort of a appreciation column about him, and I sort of called it an American tall tale. I mean, that's what it sounds like, all the archetypal sort of bootstrap kind of stuff. But he made it real. I mean, he personified it. And he was a character, and he could rub you the wrong way and be what's the word, surly, to say the least. But that was all part of, again, that was Clint being Clint. That was part of the venom and the grit that made him what he was. And so, yeah, I don't know that we'll see anything like that again. I mean, he was one of those players you couldn't take your eyes off of. I thought about this after I was writing it. I wrote this in a way, but I wish I'd written it in a different way. There was a conversation. It was when basketball fans do this all the time. Basketball fans are obsessed with arguing over who's the best of all time and whatever, and LeBron versus Jordan and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know who wrote this, and so I can't give credit. I apologize, but someone was writing about the distinction between best and greatest, and it was not something I thought about until I read this. The idea that the best is just purely looking at talent, purely looking at, can you technically do something better than someone else? Great is something different. Great is intangible. Great is, great has sort of immeasurable and emotional power behind it, right? There's something about greatness that is in addition to or different than best. And so Landon Donovan to me is still the best American soccer player of all time. Mm. He's just technically the best player. But I think Dempsey may be the greatest, because I think what he accomplished and what he fought through and what he demanded of himself and of others carries with it a gravitas that Donovan never did, despite the fact that, like, on the field, I think Donovan was, to me, clearly a more well-rounded player, a more dangerous player, a more diverse player. But Dempsey had a sense of the occasion and accomplishment and drive that Donovan didn't have. And so I think it's fair to say, and there are arguments that can be made both sides, but if someone were to conclude that Donovan is the best American player ever and Dempsey is the greatest, I'm okay with that.
Keep in mind, we're talking about the men's side here, because it gets into a whole different thing.
I think that goes without saying. Yes.
It doesn't totally.
It okay.
But I'm with you on that. I think there is a difference between best and greatest, and I think, you know, sometimes we confuse those terms also with how much somebody, like, what percentage did someone get out of their potential, right? And clearly, Dempsey got more out of his potential than Donovan did, I think.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, Donovan is who he is, right? And so if Donovan is fueled and inspired more by being comfortable and loved, and Dempsey is fueled more by adversity and anger, for example, pick different words, that's who they are as people. And I'm not going to penalize either of them. You know, you could get on Donovan's case for not spending his whole career in Europe, but you can get on Dempsey's case for kind of being a jerk sometimes, right? I mean, they're different people, and it's okay to appreciate them both. And this is why I'm glad. I would hope that we're not like the NBA fans who have to pick one. Yeah. Like we don't have to pick one. You know, they were both phenomenal and both changed American soccer. And I think what Donovan did to build, you know, Donovan staying in MLS or returning to MLS was not, there were some harder things about that too. It, you know, we all know, I mean, not only the travel and the grind that exists in MLS, but the fact that he was the guy every time, like to be the focal point of every opponent, of every defense, of every journalist, of every fan, over and over and over, week after week after week. You know, when you're in England, you can not talk to the media. When you play for a Premier League team, you're not the only dangerous player out there or the most dangerous player out there. You have better, you know, Dempsey had much better service throughout his career than Donovan had. So you can pick and cherry pick whatever statistic or facet you want. What they both did is awesome. They both were awesome, and they both advanced the sport in this country. Donovan helped make pro soccer in this country what it is now. We can criticize it for what it's not, but and there's plenty there. But for what it is, Donovan played a huge role in building that, and that should be celebrated just as much as what Dempsey did. And so they're both great. I, like I said, on a purely technical soccer level, I think Donovan was a better player than Dempsey. But Dempsey accomplished things for an American man that have never been seen before, and should be celebrated. I mean, just an outstanding career, and over abruptly. I mean, I don't know the specific reason why it was that day, but you know, the fact that he decided not to ride out the season in Seattle and kind of see if he could help contribute to another cup run was interesting.
Yeah, a couple of things I would share. I think Bob Bradley deserves a lot of credit as the U.S. men's national team coach for getting the most out of the Donovan Dempsey pairing at the same time.
Yep.
You know, he very clearly put those guys in wide positions to start, but gave them a ton of freedom to cut inside and do really cool things, and didn't ask too much of them defensively by putting them in wide positions. And that U.S. team from 2009, 2010, that was Donovan and Dempsey at their best, with the national team, I thought. I would also say I have a couple of really fun memories of Clint Dempsey over the years. I remember the first interview I ever did with him. I was living in Boston. It was 2004. He was going to win Rookie of the Year. He was drafted, if you remember, in the Freddie Adu class that year. And I asked him ahead of the interview, you know, we're on the Sports Illustrated budget here, Clint. You know, pick any place you want to meet up for a meal. And he picked the Dunkin' Donuts in Foxborough. And, you know, he was just on his way to go out fishing. Like, that was, you know, probably his priority that day. But I remember joking about that with him later on, a few years later. And when I went to do a big SI Magazine story in 2010, which I ended up posting on my Twitter last week because it's my favorite Dempsey story that I ever did. It was when he was really doing well at Fulham, and he had just scored that amazing goal against Juventus to eliminate them in Europa League. And Clint picked the lunch spot this time and took me to his favorite Italian restaurant in London, which was a pretty nice place and clearly a place where he was a regular. And we had a good time, I guess, just thinking about the contrast to 6 years earlier at the Dunkin' Donuts in Foxborough. Like, he had really made it. And he wanted to show me around London a little bit, like, including where we went back to where he was living, and it was a nice place. His wife's totally friendly. She actually was in the SI swimsuit issue once. I think they had one or two kids at the time. Now they've got four, I think. And the other thing I remember from being at their place was the story. He was real tight with Eddie Johnson,
yeah,
who was owned by Fulham but was on loan at the team Aris in Greece that Freddie Adu was at. Where I end up doing another story later that
there's
year.
There's two American originals right there, man. And Clint Dempsey and Eddie Johnson.
Well, and my favorite little nugget from that trip was that Clint was telling me how Eddie Johnson was flying his barber from London to Greece to give him a haircut.
That's excellent.
It was great.
What happened? I'm listening to the story and I'm wondering whatever happened to that SI budget, man.
A good question.
I go to Dunkin' Donuts now, and that's what I expense. My favorite memory of Dempsey is I was interviewing him at the team hotel. It was probably like 2012 or 2013, somewhere around there. And growing up as a forward, I was fixated and obsessed with scoring goals, and I would always keep track of how many goals I had and who I'd scored against and how many I had compared with other people on my team and in the league and whatever. And maybe it's the OCD in me. I have some, and I always need to know what's happening in that sense. But also that was just natural to me. And you have it pretty clearly hammered into you that that's wrong, right? That you shouldn't keep track of that. You shouldn't keep track of personal statistics, that it's about the team. Nobody wants to hear about how many goals you've scored. Not like I was like, you know, informing everybody every day of training. But that's not the way a proper player sort of comports himself. You know, a true team player doesn't even have that in his head. It's all about the team. Don't think about personal statistics. And I remember sitting with Dempsey again, 2011, 2012, somewhere around there, and he's like rattling off personal stats that are above and beyond, that are like Billy Beane shit. Like this dude knew how many goals he'd scored in the rain. This dude knew how many goals he'd scored under interim managers. He knew how many goals he'd scored on weeknights. Like it was Rain Man-esque. It was amazing. And there was this sense of, oh, it's okay. Like, if it's okay for Clint Dempsey, it was okay that I was such a jerk about, you know, how many goals I scored and for my high school team or in my stupid amateur league or whatever, because the Clint Dempsey is keeping track. And people forget. He's so lauded now, and he's so admired now. But there were times where he was, why don't you do for country what you do for club? Mm-hmm. There was criticism of him. I remember him before the 2010 World Cup going on a rant when we were at Princeton, I think, and going on a rant about how, you know, I won the bronze ball at the Confederations Cup and people forget that. And I scored against this team and people forget that. People think that I'm not doing enough. And so he would have those numbers at the ready. You know, because he was old, it was old, someone could pull the plug at any time, right? He talked about that all the time. I'm making up for lost time. I've got to cram as much as I can into this. So he attacked his career as if it could end at any moment. And when there was criticism, when there was a sense of maybe the new coach, you know, was going to bench the American, he wanted to have this stuff at the ready. And he had it at the ready for us too. And it was awesome. And I'll always remember sitting there thinking, like, I love this guy because, like, he knows how many goals he scored in the rain on a Wednesday. And that makes me just feel better about all my psychosis as a forward. And this guy's awesome. So that's my Clint Dempsey memory.
I like it. I would also say that so many people have called Clint from a media perspective kind of surly and kind of in a fun way, in a sense. We kind of knew what to expect late, especially late in his career. But in one-on-one interviews, I always really thought he was good. And there was a big difference between what he would give in one-on-one interviews, sit-down interviews, compared to sort of group interviews where he didn't always seem to enjoy that.
And I think there's an expectation. I don't know. It's cultural, I guess. But it's like, you know, if you're gonna take the glory when you win, you gotta face up to it when you lose. And we all knew after a loss, Clint wasn't talking. Clint would walk by you, eyes straight ahead, fixed gaze, and you know, if you want to be critical of that, I mean, we still got our, you know, it's not like that prevented us from doing our jobs, right? I still wrote my story and I still got my paycheck. So I mean, I don't ever think Clint stopped me from doing my job. So I'm not criticizing him for this, but I'm saying that again, within the team concept. Sometimes maybe you should talk after the loss instead of leaving it to your teammates. You know, there's Michael Bradley in front of the cameras. There's Tim Howard in front of the cameras. You know, you're leaving it to them to do this instead of doing it. So, you know, there are people who – I don't know how I feel about that. But, I mean, you could make that criticism of him that he was willing to sort of be in the spotlight when things went well. If he scored two goals, he would talk. Mm-hmm. If they lost, he didn't want to say anything. You know, people can decide among themselves whether or not that's worth criticizing. It didn't bother me on the day, just because, you know, you're on deadline, you need to get your story done, and you're not going to bother the guy who doesn't want to talk because, you know Michael Bradley will sit there for 15 minutes.
Yeah, so. I will always remember Clint Dempsey being in tears after the 2009 Confederations Cup final loss to Brazil, 3-2. U.S. had been up 2-0 on.
Yep, he scored in that game.
Dempsey and Donovan goals. And that guy was a competitor. He was crushed when they didn't win that game. And I'll also remember sitting down with him in Jamaica right after he transferred to Tottenham from Fulham. And that had been a very stressful period for Clint Dempsey, where he had been forced to train on his own at Fulham, basically forced the move. And I remember him sitting down with me and telling me how he had been in, you know, broken down in tears during that process. So, I mean, he was a guy who occasionally was willing to bare his soul a bit. And so Clint Dempsey, my guess is you might disappear from the public eye quite a bit, maybe not entirely.
You don't think he'll do what Bruce Arena did and, like, you know, 15 minutes after losing to Trinidad, show up on the Fox set?
I doubt this, yes. My guess is he's going to be doing some boar hunting and some fishing in East Texas. And I hope it's not the last we see of Clint Dempsey, but he's earned a nice break.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, I mean, there's a part of me that wonders, you know, why now? I hope it's not a health issue or an injury issue. You know, he's got, I think, only one goal this year, so he's clearly sort of tailing off. But Seattle's also on a wonderful run, so I don't know. I don't know what the decision making process was there. He may never share it with any of us. So yes, it felt abrupt. But like I said at the beginning, he's a tall tale. He's a legend. There's everything about his story, including the stuff you just mentioned. The fact that he was willing to put himself through that level of discomfort in order to, again, you know, seize the day. You know, he talked all the time to us about wanting to play in the Champions League, and he knew it wasn't going to happen with Fulham. And so he was willing to put himself through everything you described for that opportunity to do that eventually with Tottenham. And obviously that lasted only a season, I guess, but his willingness to suffer and struggle to get what he wanted was immense and amazing. And it just makes for a wonderful story.
All right. Let's end our podcast here because we've been on for a little while, but it's great to be back. Great to have you on the show. Let's do it again next week.
Oh boy. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Brian Strauss, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help the cause if you do. And check out the 30-minute Planet Football video show hosted by me and Luis Miguel Echegaray on SITV. That's available on SI.TV, Amazon, and FuboTV. See you next time.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.